Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be a liberal in America? Are the interests of true progressives still served by the Democratic Party? My guest today says a scan of the political landscape demonstrates that the American left has increasingly moved toward the middle in recent decades, a phenomenon many politicians defend as simple pragmatism. But the effect, he says, is that true leftists no longer have a vibrant party to represent their values and interests. Adolf Reed Jr. is professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. His article, Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals, is the cover story in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. Adolf, welcome to Think.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Historically, what values have defined left-leaning ideology in the United States?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, concern with economic equality has been pivotal. I mean, economic as well as other forms of equality, of course, along the lines of race, gender, sexual orientation, and the like. But the key anchor for all those has been a notion of a society that's more egalitarian on economic terms than the one we currently have.
So we were focused on egalitarianism within society, and we looked at things like how much money people were able to make, and clearly that allowed labor movements to align with the American left.
Oh yeah, so certainly. And I mean, in point of fact, if we look at the what most of us think of as the left, I mean, its roots lie pretty much as an active social force, clocking from the New Deal forward. In a broad trade union-based coalition, right, especially in the old Congress of Industrial Organizations, right, the industrial union tradition and its focus on social movement unionism, I suppose, would be what we'd call it. The civil rights movement, the early women's movement, as popular and populist. Grassroots-based mass political tendencies were always anchored by, were always part of a coalition dating from the 1930s that was anchored in the labor movement.
So, to the extent that the labor movement has been subdued over time, I suppose there are two ways of looking at it, right? There, some people might say, "Well, labor achieved its goals," and others would say, "No, it's simply that labor was outpowered by other forces."
Right, and I think a sober assessment would have to. While I've certainly heard enough of the first argument, often enough coming from my undergraduates, I think a more sober and reasoned assessment would have to. Have to go in the other direction. I mean, there were, for instance, I mean, just to give an indication of how far we've come, Franklin Roosevelt, in 1944, Franklin Roosevelt enunciated what he called the Second Bill of Rights, and they included, among other things, a right to economic security and housing, education, et cetera. And a month before the 1944 presidential election, a Roper poll found that 68% of respondents expressed a commitment to a right to a job as foundational, and indicated that they wouldn't be enthusiastic about a social system, no matter what it was called, that didn't proceed from the guarantee of a right to a job. And the following year, the Senate passed a full employment bill, which would have mandated that the federal government take as a cornerstone of economic policy full employment, and in practical terms, what that meant was calling for the federal government to trigger public investment, including public works employment, if the rate of unemployment rose above 3%, and with an eventual goal of bringing it down to 2%. In 1947, it failed in the House, and a compromise bill with no teeth in it was passed in 1946. In 1947, as part of a corporate counteroffensive against labor, the Congress passed, over President Truman's veto, the Taft-Hartley Law Bill, which which greatly circumscribed both the scope of trade union activism and tactics and strategies that unions could use. And I think that while what's sometimes called union density, that is the percentage of the workforce, of the eligible workforce that belongs to unions, continue to increase to a peak, I think, around 1955, where roughly 35% of workers belong to unions. The combination of defining foremen and white-collar workers outside coverage of the National Labor Relations Act, in addition to other kinds of workers, contributed along with employer counterattacks that really continued all the way through the post-war period but accelerated after the 1960s to have gotten us to the point where we are now, where trade union membership is down to around 9% of workers. So it's hardly the case that unions have won what they set out to win. In fact, I mean, what we've witnessed for the last 25 to 30 years is a systematic taking back of almost everything not just unionized workers, but all Americans have won in the way of social protection since the 1930s.
How did it happen that starting in the 1980s, the political right gained a new hold on power? And what was the effect on Democratic office holders and office seekers?
Well, that's a very good question. The simple way to answer the first is the victory of New Reaganism. And, of course, that didn't come from nothing either. I often point out that the last 2 years of the Carter administration were the first 2 years of the Reagan administration, or the first 2 years of New Reaganism. But what happened was, maybe some of your listeners who are as old as I am can remember that there was a lot of concern among trade unionists and other progressives when Richard Nixon was elected, because Nixon had made noises like he was going to go after a lot of social welfare state apparatus, and then didn't. And I think when Reagan was elected initially in 1980, there may have been a moment of thinking, well, he wasn't going to be as radical as it sounded like he was going to be, and then it turned out that he was. And I think what happened was that, I've mentioned this elsewhere, that, for instance, where some people, myself among them, and others, and the other scholars, spent much of the 70s trying to understand the limitations of the American social welfare state, broadly understood, from a left perspective. Once Reagan was elected and Reaganism was inaugurated, then we all sort of got caught like deer in the headlights and found ourselves in the position of having to regroup to defend the flawed institutions because they were better than nothing. And I think maybe that's sort of writ small for what happened to left of center interests in general. Trade unions were, the attack against organized labor picked up intensely with Reagan's breaking of the air traffic control union's strike in his first term as one high water of the symbolic mark. But the period of concessionary bargaining and that was forced onto unions and decertification campaigns that were forced onto the labor movement throughout the 80s into the 90s, just kind of put and similar counterattacks against the victories won by the women's movement and civil rights movement just kind of put all left forces on the defensive, and the Democratic Party became a battleground itself between the different ideological tendencies, and after Mondale's defeat in 1984, the conservative Democrats, organized institutionally under the rubric of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was formed specifically to pull the Democratic Party to the right. And it's worth noting in this regard that both Bill Clinton and Al Gore were previous chairs of the DLC. When Clinton was elected in 1992, he made clear that you know, this was what lay beneath his claim to be a new Democrat with a new covenant was really a retreat from the fundamental cornerstone of the Democratic left since the 1930s. That is, that government had a significant role to play in containing compensating for stark inequalities that were produced in the capitalist marketplace.
Well, you remind us that Bill Clinton essentially campaigned his way into office on a pledge to eliminate welfare as we knew it then.
Correct. And also in a fairly grisly ploy to show that he was willing to get tough on crime. But when we look back at the end welfare as we know it moment, it's striking in a couple of ways. One of them is that what the Clinton administration effectively did was, on one level, to eliminate the 60-year-plus commitment that the federal government had through Democratic and Republican administrations to provide direct income support for the poor. And he did the same thing with respect to the federal commitment nearly as long, only a couple of years younger, to provide direct housing support for the needy, for the indigent. And what he did in both cases was shift the target of the subsidy. That is, to the extent that so-called welfare reform came with demands for workfare, what the reform did was shift the subsidy, shift the economic subsidy from poor people themselves to employers of low-wage labor. And what the housing reform did, especially under the aegis of the HOPE 6 program that supposedly tasked with deconcentrating poverty in fixed housing units. In effect, the effect really was just to tear down the publicly funded low-income housing, to disperse poor people from the neighborhoods in which they had lived and had their attachments and connections, and send them out in pursuit of rental housing on the market with the support, the partial support of federal subsidies in the Section 8 program. But what Section 8 subsidies did was to shift the subsidy from poor people themselves looking for housing to landlords, right? And I think we can roll the tape forward and see something similar with the Affordable Care Act.
My guest is Adolph Reed, Jr. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals, which is the cover story in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can get on the line now to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with political science professor Adolph Reed, Jr. He works at the University of Pennsylvania and has authored the cover story of the March issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Adolph, I don't want to get too hung up on this question of housing, but there are people who would say that eliminating direct federal provision of housing to low-income Americans and shifting those dollars to provide subsidies so that people can buy houses on rent houses, rather, on a private market sort of spreads the impact of that government investment. Is there a hole in that argument?
Yes, there is. I mean, I've heard the argument. Yeah, I'd say there are a couple holes in it. One of them is that that one premise on which the argument rests is that poor people are mired in poverty because the poverty is concentrated and the housing is stigmatized and the poor people don't develop. The habits or the attitudes that would help them pull themselves out of poverty. I've always thought that argument was wrong-headed on its face and built on a number of questionable assumptions. Well, not questionable, absolutely bogus assumptions. Why be coy? But with respect to the material impact of the program, what many studies have found is that instead of moving from one area of predominantly made up of predominantly poor people, just given the way that the real estate markets operate and the subsidies operate within them, what is much more likely to happen is that people will move from one near-in neighborhood that's made up primarily of poor people to other neighborhoods that are made up primarily of poor people, right? So that sort of takes away a big chunk of the concentrated poverty argument, even if we grant the assumptions about poor people and their values and so forth and so on. And there are a couple of other wrinkles to it that that furthermore exacerbate the problem. One of them is that to the extent that the fixed units of public housing, or hard units, as I think they call them in the trade, tended to be concentrated to be located within central cities, and the areas to which people are supposedly deconcentrated tend to be more in suburbs. Public transportation access is likely to decline. I've seen this happen in many cities myself, as people move from the old compacted inner city neighborhood to the newer. To the new location, they're more likely to be isolated with respect to be physically isolated because of the absence or the relatively less efficient public transportation or of limited access to public transportation. But beyond that, I think the biggest problem with this, and I was actually an expert witness. Part of the expert witness team for the tenants in the famous or infamous Cabrini Greenhousing project in Chicago, when they brought suit to challenge the deconcentration plan.
People wanted to stay in Cabrini Green.
Well, they had no commitment to the buildings, right? I mean, it's true the buildings were crappy. I mean, we've been saying for some time that the city of Chicago was the biggest slumlord, or the Chicago Housing Authority was the biggest. The slumlord in the city, but what stands out about the Cabrini Green case in particular is that it's close to downtown, close to the zoo, close to the lake, in a very mixed, in economically quite mixed area. Right, there were a lot of rich people around actually, and that meant, among other things, there was a diverse bevy of commercial apparatus for people to partake of. It was in the densest and best covered space for public transportation in the city, in the metropolitan area. and was a mile or a half, a mile and a half or so from the densest concentration of so-called entry-level jobs in the city. So, from the standpoint of the ideology that supported, that purportedly sustained or justified the dispersal, it should never have been dispersed. But this gets to like the fundamental problem, which is the presumption that poor people don't have the right to have a commitment to place or to neighborhood. And in fact, when the Chicago Housing Authority emptied out its units, the largest one was the Robert Taylor Homes, which was in its heyday the biggest low-income housing project in the U.S. People were dispersed as far away as Bloomington, Illinois, which is where my son lives. That's 2.5 hours away from the city of Chicago. So, I mean, so that's one of the problems with that approach, right? That it presumes that poor people can just be moved around, and that doesn't impose a cost on themselves and their children. And which of course is a complete contradiction of the claim, right, that they're be moving away from concentrated poverty into greater opportunity, et cetera.
Another phenomenon you note in the United States is that racial justice causes have shifted from eliminating inequality to dealing with disparity. Can you talk about why the distinction is so important between those two?
Oh, sure, gladly. That's a very good question, too. I have a very good friend who's an English professor. I have a few of them, actually. And, this guy, Walter Ben Michaels, did a great book a few years ago called The Trouble with Diversity. And one of the points that he made is that, there are two ways you can think about how to measure equality, right? One of them, and this became common, the most common way of thinking about it in the half century of struggle against the Jim Crow system in the South after World War II, was that a strict notion of equality of opportunity is one metric of equality, and in a context in which the state or state and local government or the federal government imposes invidious distinctions on the basis of ascriptive characteristics, that is, characteristics that supposedly have to do with what a person is instead of what a person does, to the extent that limits are imposed by law or law-like custom, then that is an abrogation or a violation of the principle of equality of opportunity, which suggests that any individual, which would warrant that any individual should be able to rise or fall in the world based on his or her merit, that is, on what he or she does, apart from their ascriptive classifications. So I don't think any people or many people, especially not these days, would oppose that notion of equality. Obviously, there were people in the South who opposed it in the post-war period, as I can recall. But at this point, I don't think anyone would oppose that. But the problem is that and this is where I get back to my English professor friend's argument in The Trouble with Diversity, is that to the extent that the standard of social justice becomes, in effect, group parity, which is what the goal would be for those who are concerned about disparity, there's another domain of equality that's missed completely. And as he points out rather dramatically, our society would be considered just from the standpoint of strict equality of opportunity, or could be considered just, if 1% of the population controlled 95% of the resources, so long as 12% of that 1% were black, it were half women, 11% were Hispanic, and so forth and so on.
That is not the case.
Well, no, it's not the case. But if it were the case, right, then we would have conquered the disparities, right? But not have paid any attention whatsoever to the deepening problem of economic inequality. So that the 12% of the 1% would be black, but the vast majority of black people would be, down with the vast majority of everybody else, basically. If it were a society in which 1% of the population controlled 95% of the resources. So in that sense, I argue that the shift to a notion of disparity as the frame for determining what's an unacceptable kind of inequality mirrors or maps onto the broader shift within American left liberal discourse, such that we care less and less. You focus less and less on attacking economic inequality, and more and more on group parity in the distribution of inequality, basically.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Frank in DeSoto. Hi, Frank.
Hello. I wanted to also bring greetings to Professor from mutual friends, the Palmers in Chicago.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Chicago. Absolutely. Yeah, I was very close to them, as you may know.
I did wonder. I thought your article was wonderful with one exception. I thought that you sort of gave liberals more of a pass on their own particular racism as how it impacts black people. Let me just give you two examples of what I mean. Mm-hmm. The fact that liberals have been more than responsive, including our black American president, to the impact, say, on illegal immigrants of detention and incarceration, what it does to families, mm-hmm. while they've ignored that tremendously for black folks. The same way with employment, with very, very concerned about comprehensive immigration and legalizing the employment status of non-citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And while we had 22% unemployment, and the rate is going out of for youth of all ages, especially black youth. And then the final point, and I know you couldn't be held accountable for this because the article's only been out about a week,
mm-hmm.
The fact of the wonderful work out of UCLA showing the lack of innocence of young black boys, that across the board, it's not conservative, but liberals too, see black young kids as 4 to 5 years older than they are, and so therefore are never given the assumption of innocence in youth,
right.
And it's often brought down heavier kinds of police and other kinds of societal sanctions. And all of this is, so I think that there's skepticism of black folks, whether it's talked about or not.
Well, Frank, those are all great points, and you put a lot on the table, and I want Adolf to be able to respond before we have to get a break here. So thank you so much for your call.
Right, okay. I'll just say, just FYI to the listeners, Alice Palmer was the person who held the state Senate seat that she was succeeded in by Barack Obama. So it all goes around. Well, yeah, I mean, on the point about immigration and I guess illegalization of undocumented workers, I mean, I take Frank's points. And, I know a number of people have pointed out that the Obama administration has deported more people annually than his predecessor. I guess one way I would think that connects with the dynamic of racialization is this, that being undocumented is itself, obviously, I mean, this is going to sound trite when it comes out, but is itself a stigma that's quite like race, or that functions in the same way that race functions as a stigma, which is to say that the appeal of to many employers of undocumented workers is in fact that they are undocumented, and this may come with stories about the work ethic that they have, if they're Latino in particular, or Polish, depending on the part of the country that you're in. But what employers often mean by work ethic is that you don't complain because you don't have any base to complain, you don't have any rights to complain, and so in that sense, what makes importation of labor attractive to employers is precisely the fact that it's of questionable of that that the workers who are imported are constructed as a population that has minimal capacity to complain about their working conditions. I have a good I have a cousin in New Orleans who is a master electrician in the IBEW, and he's talked to me often about the working conditions that migrant Latino workers have to endure on construction sites. And he said, it gives him a picture of what slavery must have been like. So I guess what I would say in sum is that I take that point, and I completely agree with Frank about the dynamic. I would just suggest that in addition to seeing it as a racial phenomenon, that we see the racial phenomenon itself, that is the capacity of to racialize this class of workers, as part of what makes it attractive to exploit them. And I'll say, with regard to the other point, I think that's important to address as well. Yes, I mean, I haven't seen the UCLA study, but I've seen others that indicate pretty much the same thing. And certainly, in popular discussion of the Trayvon Martin case, there was a reluctance to see him as a 17-year-old child. So that's common. It's a problem, and it's another one that's good to point to.
Adolf Reed Jr. is my guest. His article in Harper's is called Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. We'll resume our conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Adolf Reed Jr., who is professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the cover story in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Adolf, another change that you have observed in liberal agendas is that they've been converted from these sort of sweeping long-term goals of the past to now being rather specific line items that can be achieved within a single election cycle. First of all, have right-leaning political goals not been similarly reduced in scope?
Well, they have been, only to the extent that they had already won the struggle to define the terms of debate, which is what Reaganism accomplished in the 1980s, right? And I think, or perhaps to put it more to the point, it's what Clintonism essentially accomplished by defining the left wing of Reaganism, if you will, as the realistic boundary of a progressive politics or of left or liberal political aspiration. And by that I mean acceptance of the priority of deficit reduction, even though the Reagan administration just talked about it, didn't plan to do it by any means, giving priority in economic policy to the will of the financial sector, first, second, and third. And as we've already discussed, never treated the federal government from social protect or from its commitments to social protection on a broad scale and your redistribution downward. So in that sense, the Republicans have been able to pursue what we might call a normal politics, that is, a politics that's incremental, because they won the larger struggle for changing the terms of political debate. And that's kind of what the problem is, that the Democrats operate within that same compass, within a horizon of imaginable possibility that's been defined by their nominal opposition, basically.
So some people would call that redefinition of the boundaries of debate in this country pragmatism. Other people would call it a capitulation to the power of the right. Is it possible, though, that the overall values of the majority of the American people have, in fact, shifted to the right over the past three decades?
Well, I really don't know what that would mean, actually. Mm-hmm. Granted, like a big chunk of my discipline measures such things. But why I say I don't really know what that means is that, I mentioned in our first segment the factoid about what 68% of Americans saw as the desirable foundation of economic policy in 1944.
Right.
I don't think that attitudes and preferences in politics are simply given, right? I think they are the product of their political struggles over defining what counts as common sense. And what we've seen happen over the last 30 years plus is not just a rightward shift in the electorate or in the thinking of the American people, but a shaping of the effective electorate in a way that makes it possible to produce relatively stable electoral majorities with coalitions that don't address the felt concerns of 40 to 50% of the population plus who would favor single-payer health or some sort of national health care system, right to a job, affordable access to college or to higher education for all, et cetera, et cetera. I think that what's happened is that insofar as the boundaries of the polar boundaries of what's considered the sensible range of public opinion have been moved to the right, and that people are encouraged to understand themselves at one or another point, within those commonly understood boundaries of the possible. Then yes, I would say the values of the American people have moved to the right, but that's not like a secular or an organic movement. It's a product of a political action itself, and that's the heart and soul of where I think the left that's aligned with the Democratic Party has fallen down.
President Obama has worked hard to define himself as more centrist than liberal or more centrist than leftist. What was it about him that convinced many people who supported him from the far left that somehow he secretly agreed with what they wanted to get done and would, turn about when he got into office?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a $64 question, as they used to say, or $64,000, depending on how old you are. That's actually the question that prompted me to undertake the book that I'm working on now. And the question is, why did so many people, to put it maybe a little more tendentiously than you did, who should have known better, that is, not good-hearted people who don't pay much attention to politics, but people who are savvy and have a history of engagement, to see in Obama things that were never there. And I mentioned Alice Palmer earlier. I mean, I lived in that state Senate district. I worked very closely with her and saw the emergence of the Obama the phenomenon from its embryonic state, and I was scratching my head then. I've been scratching my head ever since. I think The short answer is a couple of things. One of them is his knack for, which he mentions himself in one of his books, that he has a knack for encouraging people to see him as the receptacle or the vehicle of their aspirations, to feel that he's with them. And insofar as we might think, we'd consider that a worthy talent, it's a talent, right? It's a talent that's a good thing for a politician. I think the other, and he had a way of, he still does, if it hasn't worn thin yet, of evoking symbols of earlier popular movements, right? Like the way that he would present himself and let his handlers present himself as an embodiment, a literal embodiment of the fulfillment of Black American aspirations that date back to the Civil Rights Movement and earlier. I just gave a talk in which I made this point that the trope or the notion that the old cliche that in America any boy or more recently girl can hope to grow up to be president, while it was never really true for anybody, but the trope that it certainly was not true for Black boys and girls was a very, very powerful one, especially among Black Americans during the period prior to 1965 and really since. So it wasn't surprising to see, older Black people, or even younger ones, and non-Black people, just mark the moment of his actually having been elected and then inaugurated as a triumphalist moment in a number of kinds of narratives about overcoming in American democracy. He has done the same thing with the Yes We Can slogan, which he sort of appended annexed from the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee and its organizing in the field. But he sort of takes that on. So he's taken on both those images both those evocations as in effect buttressing his substantive claim to embody a kind of left transcendence, even though he never really stood for anything. And he was good at it. And I think the other facet of the answer is will to believe, right? I know you recall there were many people, and I don't have anything to say about your take on this stuff one way or the other, but I'm certain that you encountered many people who said both before and after his election in 2008 that they were really happy that someone who was like him, right, who was not Bush in all the many ways that he was not Bush, I realize this is a Dallas station, but was good for America's image both at home but especially abroad, where he would, and as he said himself, he thought that his being president with a mother who still lives in a hut on the shores of Lake Victoria and a Chinese Canadian sister and so forth and so on would say something to the rest of the world about our foreign policy and its openness and respect and tolerance for others in the world. And I read that and thought, well, yeah, sure, until the first bombs or drone strikes, and then things might be a little different. But I think that's how it was. I mean, the people wanted, he wanted people to believe in him, and people he wanted progressives to believe in him, and many of them wanted to believe in him for these historic reasons. And then there's, I think this is testament to another aspect of the victory of Clintonism in the Democratic Party, which was his claim to be a new special kind of progressive who could transcend existing differences between left and right and bring us all together, which sounds great in the abstract, but as even Hillary Clinton and Geraldine Ferraro pointed out in the 2008 campaign, you can only believe that if you've never had to actually try to do it.
So, Adolf, if progressives were to regain significant political influence and have some say in defining the boundaries of political discourse in this country at some point in the future, would the most likely vehicle for that be the Democratic Party? Or is it your sense that the DNC has been too significantly diverted from its liberal past to swing back to accommodate those on the far left?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Let me start out by saying this. You often point out that progressives got more from Richard Nixon than they got from Clinton or Obama or, for that matter, even Carter. And it's certainly not because Richard Nixon liked us any more than they do or did. But it's because the balance of social forces in the society at large was such that Nixon felt and moreover assumed that he just had to respond to labor, he had to respond to the civil rights movement. So I think that elections, so in that sense, I wouldn't say that that a progressive success would or wouldn't require some kind of engagement with the Democrats. I think the key has to be, though, that you're rebuilding a left can't be limited by the constraints of the Democratic Party, that it has to be built on the outside. And I want to be clear, too, because I think a lot of people have difficulty hearing a statement like that without sliding it into a call for third parties. I'm not calling for a third-party politics. But I do think that elections are most crucially vehicles for consolidating victories that have been won and expressing victories that have been won on the plane of social movement action. I think that's what Reaganism was. You know, the Reaganism began, one might say, when Barry Goldwater went down to what was then described as ignominious defeat in 1964. And the ultra right in the Republican Party figured out that they'd made their move too soon, and then went underground and organized right at local levels, field tested messages around issue based campaigns that sometimes involved elections, sometimes didn't. But the key was always trying to build the alliance that could be wed to a push for electoral power at some point down the road, but the key was always the alternative social vision, to which that was the glue that held the disparate elements of the coalition together.
I'm afraid we have to jump in here. The hour is up. Adolf Reed Jr. is professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Nothing Left, The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. It's the cover story in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Adolf, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thanks much for having me. I quite enjoyed it. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.